The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation magazine. I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. Ever since the Dobbs decision, the fight for abortion rights has galvanized Democratic voters like nothing else. But in Joe Biden, the party had a presidential candidate who appeared tentative and uncomfortable on this issue and out of touch with the reproductive justice movement. Biden could barely even say the word abortion. Then Kamala Harris, an enthusiastic defender of abortion rights, who has led the party's post-Dobbs response, replaced Biden at the top of the 2024 ticket. Ever since Kamala Harris, an enthusiastic defender of abortion rights, who has led her party's post-Dobbs response, replaced Biden at the top of the 2024 ticket, there's been a sense that reproductive freedom can once again take its place at the center of the Democratic campaign. But how much has the approach to abortion really shifted post-Biden? What is Kamala Harris promising voters when it comes to abortion rights? And what role can a president actually play in the fight for reproductive freedom? Here at The Nation, we're fortunate to have one of the country's leading thinkers about reproductive justice on our staff. I'm talking, of course, about Regina Mahone, Nation's senior editor, author of the Repro Nation newsletter, and co-author of the forthcoming book, Liberating Abortion, Claiming Our History, Sharing Our Stories, and Building the Reproductive Future We Deserve, which will be published on October 1st and available for pre-order now, wherever you get your books. Welcome, Regina, to See How They Run.
Thank you so much, Don. I'm so glad to be here.
It's great to talk to you. So let's start out by reminding readers how many states abortion is actually on the ballot in this November's coming election.
As of August 14th, we have abortion on the ballot in 8 states. That would be Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, South Dakota, Missouri, Florida, Maryland, and New York. And then 2 other states actually have ballots pending. So though, you know, we should know within the next few days or few weeks if it's confirmed for Montana and Nebraska as well.
And so restoring reproductive rights has obviously been a central pillar of the formerly Biden-Harris, now Harris-Waltz campaign. I noticed when I was in Philadelphia at the unveiling of Tim Walz that there were a lot of women wearing a t-shirt with a slogan that I've since seen on lawn signs, at least in eastern Pennsylvania, row, row, row your vote. So whoever came up with that slogan, hats off to them. What are you hearing from reproductive rights groups in the wake of the Harris-Waltz campaign launch? I mean, is there a sense that having Harris at the top of the ticket and Waltz on the second spot makes a difference?
Well, you hit it on the nose. Biden was never the best messenger for abortion rights. He actually not only struggled with saying the word abortion, but even said very clearly that he's not, quote, big on abortion because of his religion, in spite of the fact that plenty of religious groups, people of faith, support abortion with few, if any, limits. A lot of what Biden has done over the past three and a half years, plus all of his decades in office, is really add to abortion stigma. He's continued this concept of safe, legal, and rare that the Clintons popularized in the 90s, that we should really be grateful for the few opportunities that people can have abortion. And we really should be looking at minimizing that as much as possible. And now we see Harris, who's been this huge messenger in the administration since Dobbs, talking about reproductive freedom, talking about Trump abortion bans, really like laying it on Trump, that these abortion bans after Dobbs exist because of Trump and his nominations to the Supreme Court. So she's really doing a lot of destigmatizing work that's not very sexy to talk about, but I do think that's exciting a lot of reproductive rights organizers and activists behind the scenes. I mean, she was the first vice president to ever visit an abortion clinic, and she was there with Tim Walz in March of this year. So I think there's a lot of feeling seen, feeling represented that's happening that's like very uncomfortable because it doesn't happen very often. The other thing about Harris that I think is important to acknowledge is not just that she's been this abortion advocate, but she's also fought for reproductive justice. When she was a senator, she introduced bills around addressing maternal mortality and the Black maternal health crisis, being a sponsor of the Black maternal health omnibus bill, really looking specifically at the way that implicit bias harms people, harms Black women in our healthcare system. I mean, she's been out in front of this for a very long time. She also served on the Black maternal health caucus in the Senate. And then she is not only looking at reproductive health care and maternal health care. She's also talking about things like fighting for labor rights, fighting for Medicare for all. You know, she's come out when she was an attorney general defending the Affordable Care Act. So I think there is, you know, a lot for people to feel excited about, a lot for reproductive rights activists to feel excited about. The other thing I wanted to mention, it's important to remember, you know, she picked this running mate who was the first governor to protect abortion rights after Dobbs. So it's both Kamala Harris, but also her running mate and the way that she's just like, no, but this is our issue. We're owning this issue. We're coming out on top of this issue. You know, Walz also, it's Minnesota, which had already was protecting abortion in the state. And so, but he, you know, bolstering that protection, also signing legislation to protect people traveling to Minnesota for abortions after Dobbs, really at the forefront of all of this. It's no surprise that large groups like Emily's List, Reproductive Freedom for All, Planned Parenthood Action Fund, like the groups that can actually be talking publicly about the candidates because we're in this weird window for nonprofits. But still, these large mainstream groups are coming out in support of her, and it's really not a surprise at all.
Well, that's great. I want to get, if we can, a little bit into the weeds because somehow I missed the Walz Harris visit to an abortion clinic in March. So can you say a little bit more about, you know, where that was and how it came about?
They visited a clinic in March of this year. It was in St. Paul, Minnesota. And, you know, because Harris has been out doing these interviews, talking to activists on the front lines and really making it clear to everyone that this is her issue, that this is the administration that's owning it. And I feel like in a lot of ways, sort of like making up for Biden struggling to say the word abortion by just like really being out front and at a clinic. So really visiting a clinic to see, you know, especially for blue states that are getting a lot, you know, an influx of patients from other states, seeing in the clinic, like what access is like, what are the challenges and really talking to people. And so it was really smart of her to visit a clinic, I think. And because he's the governor, and of course he's a pro-abortion rights governor, he was there alongside her. That makes perfect sense. Whether or not he was, you know, gaming for to become her VP, when I think it was pretty
well
early
in March.
Yeah,
I think pretty early for that. Yeah. But on the other hand, it it's an interesting note of context to her choice. You know that's
absolutely
that they did that together. I mean, and also, you know, one of the other things about Tim Walz, of course, which he's been very public about, is that he and his wife had their own IVF journey, which they talk about, you know, and which led to the birth of their daughter, Hope, because it's not, as you say, it's not just abortion, it's reproductive freedom. And, you know, there are states that want to take away, Alabama rushes to mind, but it's not the only state that want to take away the right to IVF.
And I do think that's why she's so clear about reproductive freedom when she's talking about abortion rights, because she knows, like we all know, it's not just abortion. And, you know, it's both abortion care, but it's also the right attacking, using the same shell organization, shell, you know, to litigate against abortion rights and also IV, you know, in vitro fertilization, contraception, all of these other ways that people might choose to create their families.
Right. Well,
or not.
or not.
Create a family. Yeah.
Well, you know, or create a different kind of family. But I mean, one of the things that was striking to me about their campaign is that they've kind of tried to reclaim the word freedom as a term for the left. You know, that was very much the kind of mind your own damn business, which was Waltz's message about people who want to tell us who we can love, who we can marry, what we can read, and they want to tell women what they can and can't do with their bodies. So,
and not just women, people, trans kids, right? They're also very clear about supporting gender affirming healthcare for trans kids. I mean, it is the spectrum because all of these issues are interconnected.
Right. Well, that's something I want to talk a little bit more about. The Nation did a special issue of Body Politics, which you co-edited, and you and Emily Douglas, who was the other co-editor on that issue, wrote, "The bravery of everyone fighting back is not only changing the landscape on the ground, it's also changing the way we understand what it means to achieve liberation, for everyone to be able to do what he or she or they want with their own body, free of political constraint." Talk a little bit about how this vision of liberation and the body fits into a larger vision of political struggle and indeed freedom, in terms of, you know, not just lack of constraint, but also power relationships within our society.
So I'm actually going to go to something that Kamala Harris has been saying, actually, because I think it's really important what she's doing with this freedom language, to go back to what you were saying, because she's placing the right to abortion in this context of the founding principles of the country and the freedom to make decisions about our own bodies without the government interfering with those decisions. So that's liberation, that's freedom. And if you can apply it broadly, right, to the people we decide to have intimate relationships with, to our decisions about whether or not we're going to have children, to our decisions about whether or not we want to make alterations to our body to feel more inside of our body. And so all of those things are connected because the government and the right in particular is looking to attack our ability to make those decisions as a way to hold on to power, because it's all for them about political power. And the more we're able to exercise freedom for ourselves and feel that we are and live out that pursuit of happiness in this country, the more that's a threat to the right and to white supremacy. And so when Kamala Harris is talking about this freedom to live without the government in our decisions and our bodily autonomy and our bodily choices and our reproductive choices, she's really talking about our right as citizens that wasn't given to us. It's what we just have as part of this country. And it is so important to frame all of these things in this way, because it's not about whether or not parents can make decisions about their children, or it's about us as individuals being able to live freely. And all of those things are connected. I hope that makes sense.
Well, it makes sense, but let's tease it out a little bit, because it's not just living freely. It's also owning your own body. I mean, you know, after all, when the country was founded, not everybody had the right to own their own body. Women didn't own their bodies. They were, in many states, they were the property of their husbands. And, you know, African Americans in the South didn't own their own bodies. So there's partly, you know, there's a sense in which the ground zero of political power is always the body, but it can be obfuscated. So in a way, what's remarkable about this moment is that it's come back to the body in this very clear way. I mean, I'm partly thinking about abolition and, you know, and the idea that all Americans own their own bodies and can make their own decisions, but also about different kinds of constraint. In other words, there's the law, but there's also, as you've said, stigma. There's religious dicta. You know, there are all kinds of pressures that society applies on people about what they can and can't do with their bodies. And, or maybe another way into it is to say, you said these are not rights that we were given. And I would say these are not rights that we were given. These are, in some cases, rights that we had to fight for.
Absolutely. And demand, right? That's, that's the civil rights movement that was demanding these rights being honored and people being treated with dignity. It's also, I do struggle a bit with focusing so much on body because it's such an, you know, we did, of course, name the issue, like our body politics issue, but to, you know, it becomes so easy to stigmatize body. Like it feels like it's easier to take control away when we're talking about bodies. And maybe that's because we've taken control away for so long of our bodies that it feels like the wrong thing to focus on. When I'm explaining it to people, when I'm talking about abortion, when I'm talking about all of these issues, I like to just focus on the fact that, like, you as an individual should be able to make decisions about how you live your life, because that is, as an American citizen of this, you know, being a citizen of this country, a resident of this country, you are granted that freedom. And when the right comes in and says, well, you can be a citizen, but also, well, you can't have an abortion in this state. You can only have it in this state. And there's also the systemic part of this, and this feels like I'm going in a bunch of different directions, but it also feels very related. The systemic part of it, which is that when we're taking away people's ability to do anything, you know, to access healthcare, which is what we're doing with abortion, which is what we're doing with gender affirming care, which for trans kids is healthcare, right? Like, that's mental healthcare. That's just healthcare. When we're taking that away, we're actually affecting the provision of care. We're limiting where care is accessible. And then when there's a crisis like we're seeing right now with more and more people needing second trimester abortions, third trimester abortions for any number of reasons, often critical, there's no provider, there's no care because someone decided you can't do that with your body. There's the cultural part of it, there's the societal part of it, but then there's an actual very practical, like, systems level part of it that is being interrupted by people with deep pockets making decisions about how we live our lives.
I was thinking about that pioneering, you know, feminist book from the 60s and 70s, Our Bodies, Ourselves, and that that effort to take the body back by feminists. But I also think that it's easy to get hung up, and maybe this is what you were getting at. It's easy to get hung up at the personal level of bodily autonomy.
Yes, the individual level of bodies. Yes, 100%.
And, you know, so
take us. Because all of us are affected by all of these decisions and changes.
So pan back a little bit. I mean, you're a woman and you live in a state and you have a pregnancy that you don't want to continue, or maybe you feel you can't continue. Maybe you feel your mental health or your physical health is in danger if you continue it for whatever reasons. You need to terminate it, but you live in a state where abortion has been the right, which was, you know, enshrined in Roe v. Wade, has been taken away by Trump's Supreme Court. How do these systemic things start to affect you?
Sure. I mean, and they may affect people even before they need an abortion. They may affect people who just need to go get their annual pap smear and there are no appointments because people from out of state are coming into the state and filling up those appointments. I mean, there's, going back to the provision of care aspect of this, this affects everyone. And that's why we say if everyone doesn't have all these rights, then no one has these rights because everyone is affected whether or not they seek an abortion or not. But if you are a person who becomes pregnant and doesn't want to be, and then you're starting to look for appointments, you're running into the same scenario. You might want to go to the state of New York for an abortion, and you find out that, oh, you have to wait 3 weeks, 4 weeks for an appointment, except that means now you are in the second trimester. That means, and so now it costs you maybe, you know, from $500 or $1,000, maybe $10,000, $20,000 for your appointment, and the insurance won't cover parts or all of the procedure because, again, we have the system set up where abortion is stigmatized. It's not treated as healthcare like you would need, you know, if you go to the doctor and you have to get a wisdom tooth pulled out or something else. If you are insured, if you have dental coverage, you're likely to have that procedure covered and you're not having to pay out of pocket for that. Except you're talking about a person who's actually potentially going to give birth to another person if they have to keep that pregnancy. And so the impact isn't just on them as an individual. It's their future. It's their whole life. It's their families. It's everyone who has to kind of get involved in that experience with them to continue to live and support themselves.
The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
Why do you think the Democratic Party has had such a hard time historically with this issue?
With abortion?
Yeah.
Power. It's all about power. It's all about holding power. And Democrats are more, the Democratic Party has historically been more interested in doing everything possible to hold on to power or to keep scraps or the bits of power that they can instead of pushing for meaningful change that would actually change people's lives, because they're afraid that those things aren't popular. They're afraid that those things, you know, they'll lose voters, and maybe they will, but ultimately, like, that kind of, you know, activists in the 70s and 80s were calling for free abortion. We're calling for repeal all abortion laws, because of course we saw a wave of abortion laws after Roe and then and continued to this, you know, to Dobbs. And so Democrats had the entire time of that, those decades to really codify what was in Roe v. Wade, and they didn't. And a lot of it, of course, is because they were trying to appease moderates to keep, you know, what Obama did with the Affordable Care Act. There is a Hyde Amendment attached to it because he was trying to get the Affordable Care Act through. And in order to get it through, he needed to make sure that moderate Democrats who were anti-abortion were happy. So that's just historically been the case.
Well, let's talk about those moderate Democrats who were anti-abortion. I mean, my sense is that there aren't really any of them left. And I'm partly saying that because I'm coming to you today from Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania, where one of the two senators, Bob Casey, was for a long time a kind of anti-abortion Democrat. But he changed. So I wondered what you think about people's capacity to change and what movements have done to get people to change.
Of course, personal stories have been attributed to, I don't know if it was Casey or someone else, there was another lawmaker who changed their perspective on abortion, and it was because of the personal stories that they had heard and shared with other people. Representative Barbara Lee is doing a lot of that in her advocacy for the EACH Act, which would end the Hyde Amendment, which was starting in 1977, blocking access from Medicaid beneficiaries to use their insurance to get an abortion unless they qualified for a rare exception like rape or incest. Those exceptions aren't always accepted, even if people had those direct experiences. But she's talked about in her work and in news articles about her how when she speaks publicly about her personal experience, and she said, no one needs to know what's going on in my life, but because of what's going on in this country, she's sharing it. She feels compelled to share it. She's had people come up to her, religious people of all faiths, of all walks of life, come up to her and talk about how hearing her experience opened up their eyes, or hearing, you know, encourage them to start sharing their own experience with abortion and things like that. I mean, abortion is so many people are affected by it. Renee Bracey Sherman, my co-author and collaborator, came up with the slogan, everyone loves someone who's had an abortion. It's true. Like, it's undeniably true, even though it's maybe tricky to fact check, but still it's true. And that in and of itself, and the way that people are more and more telling their stories, I do think that in and of itself, and I'm hopeful that that is the case as a journalist, as someone who's co-written a book with a lot of stories. Those stories are powerful. We see the impact of them every day. And so I do think a lot of that comes down to storytelling.
So in addition to doing more storytelling and better storytelling, what do you think else needs to be done, both in this campaign and beyond, to not only bring back Roe, but strengthen? Because as you point out, you know, the Hyde Amendment meant that even when Roe was the law of the land, poor women still had very great difficulties in getting access to health care because of the Hyde Amendment. So
yeah, and the Hyde Amendment is still the law of the land, and it affects not only Medicaid beneficiaries, it also affects anyone on government-sponsored insurance. So veterans, you know, people in the military, people who work for the government, the federal government, people who receive Indian Health Service benefits, like all of those people and more are affected. Their children are, you know, there's so many people who, not just poor people, but it did certainly start with the tax on preventing people from being able to use their insurance started with poor people. But then also in some states, through the Affordable Care Act exchanges, they're blocking people's ability to use their own insurance without Hyde, you know, just their regular insurance from accessing abortion care. So this is, you know, it starts in one place and then it expands because Democrats allow all of the status quo to remain. And then the right just kind of builds on it and builds on it until it affects everyone. And so that's also affecting now what we're seeing with people needing second trimester abortions more and more, where there's this lack of access because the clinics don't exist, or there are very few clinics that exist, and people are having to pay, you know, $20,000-$30,000 or more for their abortions, which is just wild. But I will say, you know, Harris is talking about how when her line in her stump speech is that, you know, when Congress sends her a bill when she's president, when Congress sends her a bill to restore reproductive freedoms, she's going to sign it. That's her response to it, right? And this idea of restoring reproductive freedom sounds so similar to restoring Roe, and it's a little unclear, like, what that reproductive freedoms means. But I do think she's actually looking beyond Roe because of the way that she talks about abortion. As we said, the way that she talks about it as, you know, a fundamental right in this country, as part of our founding principles, it's a freedom to be able to live without government interference, and really framing it that way. And also, she's often talking about abortion rights and voting rights in the same breath. I'm sure you've noticed that, Don, because you've seen her. She'll talk about fundamental freedoms that were attacked, and then she lists them, and often it's voting rights and then abortion rights. And so really, you know, because often when Renee and I were doing our podcast, you know, the question was like, how is it that abortion is so popular and yet, you know, almost half the states have banned it or have extreme restrictions on abortion? And it's because of gerrymandering. It's because of this undermining of our voting rights that our votes aren't being counted. But then we're seeing this wave of ballot amendments. We talked about the 8 states at the top of this that are looking to put into their constitutions the protections, the protections for abortion rights, because that's voters speaking back and pushing back against what we've seen with the right really holding on to these political offices in their states and preventing the people who actually represent the people in those states from gaining office and putting forth this progressive legislation that would really open up abortion rights. But I will say, in terms of, you know, there are some really strong pieces of legislation like the Women's Health Protection Act or the Abortion Justice Act that Kamala Harris could put into place if she gets, you know, the Congress she needs to make this happen when she becomes president. But no matter what, often this legislation is falling short because it's within this framework that was established by the Roe v. Wade decision, which was that there are 3 trimesters in a pregnancy, and the first trimester, good abortion. Second trimester, most often not a good abortion. Third trimester, bad abortion. And as I said, then it's created this,
it's a hierarchy.
Yes, this dearth of clinics. And so, you know, we as Democrats, we as people on the left really need to grapple with our discomfort with abortions throughout pregnancy and access to care throughout pregnancy, because what we're seeing right now is the consequence of that trimester framework really poisoning our healthcare system, because there aren't enough clinics, there aren't enough providers with that care, with that ability to provide that care. And we also have a significant number of Catholic hospitals in this country that are denying people, even in states where abortion is legal, even before Roe was overturned, denying people access to care because of their religious objections. But yeah, we're seeing the consequences of the trimester framework and the way that now there are fewer clinics because the cost of care is extremely expensive, and we're talking about people needing healthcare.
It seems like some Republicans know that they've lost this argument, in terms of polling and in terms of even, as you know, as you've covered in the nation, states like Kansas have codified the right to an abortion in their constitution. Wherever it's been offered on the ballot, and let's hope this prevails in these eight states, voters have voted to preserve this freedom or even to expand it. But one of the things that I heard a couple of times at the Republican convention was this insane claim from Trump that, you know, the Democrats not only are in favor of abortion, they're in favor of allowing infanticide, or as they say, still living babies. And I wondered, I mean, it's grisly, but I also wonder what you think that's about.
Well, one, it's not real. And two, I mean, it's abortion stigma. It's just like the, quote, partial birth abortion ban, which made it illegal to offer a form of abortion that's really the best option for people who are looking to have pregnancies in the future. So the right finds any way, you know, they're calling these things dismemberment abortion. They've been very effective at, you know, twisting language, finding ways to make us all feel really gross about abortion care, when again, it comes down to people's ability to access the healthcare that they need. And honestly, I've had two children. I've had two C-sections. They're disgusting. I've been awake for both of them. And so, like, what aspect of healthcare isn't, you know, it's not precious. It's not pretty. Like, yeah, I've seen, like, without getting into details, it's not pretty what they're doing to get the, you know. But anyway, the right finds any way possible to make an abortion sound worse than when we're talking about someone being forced to keep a pregnancy. I have a lot of thoughts about this stuff. But anyway, no, it's just to gross people out. That's what it is at the end of the day.
One of the things that was striking about what Republicans did from the 70s till the overturning of Roe was that they mobilized voters on this issue as single issue voters. So, you know, you could say, we don't like Donald Trump. We think he's immoral, or we think he's gross, or we think he's this or that, but he's promised that he'll end abortion, or he's promised to appoint justices who will repeal Roe, or, you know, this candidate, they're maybe too conservative on other things, but they're pro-life. I hear a lot from evangelical voters that, you know, that's their issue and that's what they're voting on. And I'm wondering, have we failed to cultivate single issue voters on this, or do you think that would have been a mistake?
I think it would have been a mistake to focus, because that's why the reproductive justice movement exists, because it's not only about abortion access. It's also about people's ability to decide if, when, and how they form their families. And if we were to do what the right did, we're not necessarily motivating people who do feel strongly about not having abortions, but also see how they may have relatives who are forcibly sterilized, or all of these issues being connected. And so as much as it feels almost easy to say, like, oh, the left didn't do enough of that. But I don't.
So maybe it's that we see these issues as connected, which they are, and that makes responding more complicated. Is that?
Yes.
We're less than 3 months from the election, and this was, abortion and reproductive freedom were always going to be at the center of the Democrats' appeal. But what do you think we should look out for, particularly over the next few months, in terms of what do we want to hear the candidates say? What do we want to hear Trump and Vance being challenged on? What would a responsible media do in paying attention to this over the next 3 months?
Well, of course, as we will be covering, having control of Congress is such an important part of this. And so as much as we want to continue to hear what the Harris-Waltz campaign has to say about their policy platforms, we know because Kamala Harris is the vice president and she's signed on to the Democratic Party platform and, as part of Biden's, his running mate. So, or not running.
Well, when she was his running mate.
When she was his running mate. So we know where she's going with her policy. So seeing how she continues to support Senate candidates throughout the country, other candidates running in the House, running to hold their seat or to get a seat in the House on the left. We also know there are a number of crises that are related to abortion rights and are about reproductive justice. Things like the country's continued support for Israel's war on Palestinians or the lack of sufficient action on the climate crisis. I mentioned I had children. I mentioned I had two C-sections. I am thinking about this constantly because I'm thinking about the world that my children are going to live in and what that world's going to look like and whether or not they can decide for themselves if they can have children because of the climate and what's going on. And so all of these things are tied together. We have to continue to demand change and demand our rights. And we have to also continue to push Kamala Harris, who's coming out in support of reproductive freedom because of all of the groundwork that was laid by the grassroots organizers, by the smart messengers like Renee, all of these folks who've pushed our leaders to be a reflection of the people on the ground who want change and who want this new world that we're envisioning. And so I think we're just going to have to continue to do that in addition to hoping that, they're continuing to do something about what's happening with Israel and in Gaza and to do something about the climate and all of these other issues that are crucially important to people's ability to have families or to have families without children, whatever that looks like for them.
To thrive, for people to thrive.
Exactly.
Well, Regina, thank you for that reminder that as we go forward, it's not just the leaders or the candidates that we here at The Nation want to pay attention to. It's very much the grassroots and the people on the ground level, activists, organizers, movements. So we'll be bringing you more coverage of that as well here on See How They Run. But thank you again, Regina. Thank you again, Regina Mahone, senior editor of The Nation. And remember, you can pre-order Regina's book, Liberating Abortion, Claiming Our History, Sharing Our Stories, and Building the Reproductive Future We Deserve, wherever you pre-order your books.
Thanks, Don.